You're listening to NewYorkTalkRadio.net.
Stay tuned for Steal This Radio with Mitchell Cohen.
There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Welcome back to Steal This Radio. This is Mitchell Cohen here in New York, and I'm here with Sandy Griffin in the studio and Sean Velasquez. We're continuing this interview with Derek Jensen. Derek's the author of Walking on Water, Reading, Writing, and Revolution, and also a whole slew of other books. So welcome, Derek Jensen.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here. I've got a novel coming out this fall. And there's a character in it who, at one point, actually at a few points, does some drugs. And I didn't know how to write those scenes at all. There's one character who does drugs. He does crack because he likes it. Another character hooks his cousin who's dying of cancer on a street drug because he doesn't want to go back to hospital. Hooks him on some sort of drug to get him through it and finally overdoses him at the person's request. But he's hooked him on it first to kill pain. I said to my students, so what drug would you use? Were they using morphine or something? They all started laughing at me, and one of my students made a big square in the air with his fingers to show I was a square, and then they told me it'd be tar heroin. So I said, I don't know anything about it. And so they told me how to write the scene, and then I wrote it and I brought it back to them, and I said, no, you don't have it yet. This isn't what tar heroin smells like. Tar heroin evidently smells terrible. It smells, they say, if you're not a junkie, it makes you just want to vomit. Bitter and vinegary, they said. So they told me all about this. So I went back and worked on it again, brought it back, read it to them, like, nah, you still don't have it. And then they've got it so it's perfect, and they're all really excited. And then I read it to another class I hadn't read it to yet, and they're like, oh, man, Derek, you got this other secret life we didn't know about. And I went back and told the first class about that. My reason for telling you all this is because...
Yeah, why are you telling us all of this?
It's because that was one of the things I'm most proud of that I did when I was teaching there, because my students got to be experts, and... For once, they got to be the person in charge and to tell a free staff, get that language, free staff, how much worse could it be? They got to tell a free staff how to do something. They got to tell a free staff something that they know about intimately and, frankly, they love. When so much has been taken away from them, how wonderful was it that for 2.5 hours they got to be an expert? And it helped the scene tremendously, obviously, but I was so happy that they got to be in charge for a while. I had a friend years ago who taught at an inner city elementary school, and she took the kids out for a field trip to just a city park, like not an inner city park, but out to a more of a greenbelt type park. Some of her students were running terrified from butterflies. Just even saying that makes me want to cry.
Hmm.
I mean, these children had never seen a butterfly.
Where were those kids from?
Oh, they were from an inner city.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't have any butterflies in that particular inner city.
Mm.
I mean, are there butterflies in inner city New York?
I don't know. The word inner city itself is an interesting concept, but we'll come back to that some other time.
Well, we could say, I mean, in this case, they were also impoverished, but the point is not their level of impoverishment, well, of physical impoverishment. What I meant by inner city is that surrounded by lots of concrete and then miles of concrete and more miles of concrete, which means that a butterfly would have to fly through miles of no food and lots of automobiles in order to even get to where they live.
Right, that's one of the advantages of Detroit that I'm aware of.
Where
the inner city has been so decayed that they cleared out through urban renewal all these areas and didn't build anything, and nature is reclaiming it.
They're like bobcats.
Yeah, there's bobcats, there are ringneck pheasants. I was visiting there right in the middle of the city. It was amazing, the wildlife that was there. So,
you know,
this hopeful sign.
Yeah, wonderful sign. There are some people, especially nature haters like Sam Harris, who say that the lesson from all the mass extinctions is that nature's really nasty. But the lesson that I learned from all the mass extinctions, you know, the five great extinctions or however many, is that life really wants to live. Even when something gets thrown at it, life really wants to live. And that's the lesson I get from seeds pushing their way through concrete, is life wants to live.
Did you see the frightened ones? Did you hear the falling bombs? Did you ever wonder why we had to run for shelter with the promise of a brave new world unfurled beneath the clear blue sky?
Another thing I wanted to say about the question of knowing nature is that when Tecumseh was trying to rally all sorts of Indians to fight back against the whites, one of the arguments that he used, he was standing on a tree and he said, you know, when the whites come, they're going to cut down all the trees and make fence rows with them. Think of these trees that you have had these long relationships with, that you slept under when you're a child and you played under when you're younger and then you had sex under when you're older. And then you come back from hunting and you rest under the tree. These trees you've had this long relationship with. And you know what? I've been working on these issues for years. I live in the middle of a forest. I have never had a, I'm 48 now, And I've not had a 20-year relationship, a 30-year relationship with one tree. I live 3 miles here from old growth, but even though it's old growth, I have never seen a fully healthy forest, because the forests here are very salmon dependent, and the salmon are getting hammered. So I don't know what it's like. It's actually quite warm here this winter. I live in a rainforest, and we've only had 22 inches of rain this winter, and that's insane. That's
this
horrible.
Is the Pacific Northwest, which is usually much more rain in the past.
Yeah, I think normal is like 50-some inches.
Have the frogs started culling it?
No, they have not, and I'm going to start freaking out in 3 or 4 days. I keep track every year of when they first start calling, and the latest it's ever been since I've lived here, which is 10 years, is February 6th. And I haven't even heard a peep. And usually I hear like a few croaks just for a couple days before they really start singing. There's nothing, but there's 40% chance of rain Thursday. Okay, my point is...
It's snowing here in New York today, by the way. It's really beautiful out today.
Oh, good.
Yesterday it was 55 degrees, and today it's snowing.
Well, see, here's the deal, is that it would be wonderful to be able to have strange weather and not worry that weather patterns are changing. You know, 500 years ago, if there would have been a winter like this, and there may very well have been, the people would have just remembered it forever as the year it was really warm, and, you know, that one guy died, and that little girl was born, and that was the year that those two got together, and that was the year it was really dry. But now it's like, okay, is this the year? Because this culture is changing all that so much, and we also don't have that long history in place. I was talking to an Anishinaabe woman years ago, and she was talking about how her people knew that the martens, type of weasel, that the martens would have a big migration every 7 human generations. And isn't that cool? Because they've been living in place long enough to know patterns that are every 150 years.
And when you were talking about the martens, I thought you were talking about a family, like from the Ionesco play. Or...
Right.
Hey, Derek, we're going to have to take a break here.
We'll be back soon with more from Derek Jensen, so join us.
Goodbye, blue sky, goodbye.
Welcome back to Steal This Radio. We're talking with Derek Jensen and Sandy Griffin, and I'm Mitchell Cohn and Sean Velasquez here in the studio in New York on Steal This Radio.
I heard you speak in Edwardsville last spring and sharing the CD, letting other folks listen to it. Sometimes I get really strong, fearful reactions. What's he trying to do? What's he trying to instigate here? What do you mean? You know, if civilization tumbles down, people will die. You know, my kids won't make it to college, or I don't know. There's all kinds of fears wrapped up. And I don't know how to reach people or help them out of denial or help them understand these bigger issues.
The fact is that this culture has overshot carrying capacity, and there will be a big die-off of human beings. The planet cannot support this many people. And every cell in my body wants for there to be a voluntary transformation where we relocalize voluntarily and everything is nice and orderly. But you and I both know that ain't going to happen. I've got a book coming out in about a month called Songs of the Dead, and that's my first novel. That is basically about a character who can be standing somewhere and then suddenly he will see how things were. He'll fall through time so that he'll see how things were 10 minutes ago or 100 years ago or how they will be 10 minutes from now. It's not like Back to the Future or anything where he doesn't go back in time. He just sees what it was. So he could be standing in New York, and all of a sudden he hears passenger pigeons flying overhead. And he sees the old-growth forest that was, that's now New York City. And then I've got a book coming out in April or so. It's written with Eric McBay called What We Leave Behind. On one level, it's about decay. Like, waste up until 100 years ago really was something that, like human waste, was food for someone else. If you poop, that's good food for the soil. And now people are creating plastic, and nobody has ever, ever, ever eaten plastic. And that's a very bad thing, because if nobody eats it, it sticks around basically forever. And so that's why there's so much plastic in the ocean. By becoming sort of an inorganic society, this culture has created all sorts of waste that lasts forever, as opposed to waste that decay within a short time. And that book's coming out in, I think, April.
You know, I remember back in school when I was in Students for a Democratic Society, which is the largest radical student movement in the United States in history, actually, back in 1969. And I was just turned 20, and we were asked to go and speak in high schools, which we did for the moratorium. And we went to a school in Plainview, New York. And I remember so vividly because the teacher was a right-wing teacher in this high school, and he put these students together, set three different classes. So there are literally 100 kids in this one classroom, and they were jammed in to hear us, which is a good thing. But the teacher did this with the idea that he was going to best us, that he was going to show them. And we were just kids. I mean, we were young activists, but young. And we didn't know how to deal with the situation. There were four of us that came from Stony Brook University, and the teacher started talking to the students for about 5 or 10 minutes, gave a vicious right-wing talk about why we need the war in Vietnam at that time, why we shouldn't pull out, why the bombing is okay, the murder of eventually 2 million Vietnamese is fine, the Agent Oranging, all that. It was like one cliche after another fell from his lips, and he was a social studies teacher in high school. And the kids are sitting there totally frozen in their seats, taking notes because he told them to take notes. And then we have to come and talk. And I went first, and I was trying to think while I was going up to the front of the room what to say, because we don't want the kids to sit there frozen and not be able to learn. It's something that I think, Derek, you've been talking about, is how do people learn? How do you get people to free up their minds to the degree that they're able to delve into their own experiences and pull something out that's in them that they don't know that's even there? So I get up to the front of the room, and I act just like the teacher acted, I decided. And I say, now this is going to be very important. I want you to take notes and write everything down. And I started writing on the blackboard, and the kids were writing what I was writing on the blackboard. They were writing it in their notebook. And I wrote the word my, and people wrote my, teacher, teacher. And I ended up writing, my teacher is a fang fuckle on the blackboard. And the kids had written this in their notebook. So they couldn't take it back, right, because it was already written. The next thing you hear is from the back of the room a little chuckling. And the next thing you know, the whole class explodes in this roaring laughter. The teacher's like, wow, it was amazing. The teacher was furious. He started screaming.
I'm going to get the principal on you.
We all stood up. The SDS was now suddenly larger than life. And we go, go get your bourgeois principal. You know, and every single one of those kids, we didn't have to give any lecture after that on the class. Every single one of those kids came to the demonstration that we were there to get them to at Stony Brook that next few days. It was amazing. They were against the hierarchy and the repulsion and the, not so much in your brain, but the experience of breaking loose. You can't even predict it ahead of time. You can't say, well, I think I'm going to break loose now. The actual experience of that happening made this huge difference in people's lives. And it was a lesson that I learned later, because we did it just spontaneously, but we learned to do that as a way of helping people to unleash themselves. You don't free anybody. People have to free themselves.
There's a piece on one of those CDs that Derek describes, one of his first writing exercises. He asked the students to stretch their fingers and then fold this thumb, now fold this finger, now fold this one. And he says, and don't forget to hold that up to me and all authority.
And Sandra now is folding her fingers, and the only one left standing is the middle finger that she's forced to get.
He doesn't mark that. So what came to my mind during your piece, and babies are born with a desire to learn. I mean, that's what they're here for, and it's what they're focused on. And something happens during schooling where that starts receding. You see less and less of that till my experience with third graders. They were already distancing themselves. They were learning that school was boring, and that learning things was boring. And it's very sad to see. I don't know how we can get people of different ages back in touch with that original desire that we're all born with as humans.
If you look up the words, do a Google search for Obama and Messiah, not as a phrase, but the two words, there's more than 3.5 million hits. If you do a search for the words Jesus and Messiah, there's 800,000 hits. like four times as many for
that's
Obama
John,
and Messiah.
That's John Lennon's famous statement.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, there you go. And my point on all this is that when the economy begins to collapse, that's an emergency. But when the oceans are collapsing, that's page 24 news. So we're not going to have a voluntary transformation. So the people who get really scared, what you should do is replay for them the part where I talk about how if you're really frightened, if your concern is for the people who are going to die during the crash, then what you need to do is to start preparing them for the crash by start ripping up asphalt and putting in local gardens. Don't blame me, because I'm simply telling the truth that the planet can't support this many people.
You know, a lot of the stuff that we've been talking about, the destruction of the earth, the oceans, the vast magnitude of what we're facing makes us often want to shrink away from, you know, it's just too big. How do you get a handle on it? And we start blaming people who tell the truth about them as the messenger. You blame the messenger for it rather than deal with that. And it's interesting to think about, how does one deal with being skeptical and not believing the lies that the government is telling, and then you put them out there anyway?
I guess that some people are clinging to the idea that there's going to be some technological breakthrough, that, you know, solar energy is going to happen and we'll make this transformation in a different way. We get to keep technology. We get to keep 6.6 billion people.
Well, the non-sarcastic way that I can respond to that is that they should read Richard Heinberg's The Party's Over, which shoots down all of the alternative energies on a straight biophysical level, shows why all of them can't work to replace oil. So that's that. And then the sarcastic way is, well, great, and if that doesn't work, then the Easter Bunny will do it for us. You want to risk the whole world? I mean, the life of the planet? You want to risk the life of the planet on some mystical hope?
Well, it's the worst kind of magical thinking.
Yeah, absolutely the worst kind.
We'll be back soon with more from Derek Jensen, so join us.
Living in the wasteland of the free. We got preachers dealing in politics and diamond mines. And their speech is growing increasingly unkind. And they say they are Christ's disciples. They don't look like Jesus to me. It feels like I am living in the wasteland of the free. We got politicians running races on corporate cash. Now don't tell me they don't turn around and kiss them people's ass. You may call me old-fashioned, that don't fit my picture of a true democracy. It feels like I am living in this wasteland. We got CEOs making 200 times the workers' pay. They'll fight like hell against raising the minimum wage. If you don't like it, mister, they'll ship your job to some third world country across the sea. It feels like I am living in the wasteland. Little kids with guns fighting inner city wars. So what do? We put these little kids behind prison doors. We call ourselves the advanced civilization. That sounds like crap to me. Feels like I am living in the wasteland.
Well, I remember when I was in prison, the first time I was in jail, and I was in for a week or so, and Derek, you were talking about how you never talk about pornography in jail. Well, fortunately, I was locked in my cell as a new 20-year-old. Was it 20? I was 19, and I'm in this jail, and a delegation of prisoners came to my cell, and the leader of this group, it was of the white prisoners, actually. There was one leader of the black prisoners and one leader of the white prisoners. And it's amazing how the hierarchies continue. The white leader, who is a big bruiser guy with tattoos all over, and it turns out that he was a poet. So, and he said, well, I have a poem. I hear that you write poetry, and I want to know what you think about it, he said to me, with all these people out there. So I listening to his poem, and it was all a pornographic poem. He's writing it, and her bright red luscious lips, and it's whatever he could imagine he was working. And it actually was pretty good for a stupid type of poem in a way. He actually had some flair in there. And I told him that it's pretty good, but I made the mistake of then saying, well, I'd like to know what you think of one of my poems. And I took out a poem. I didn't even get to read it. This, the idea that there was competition in the jail set him off and the others off. And I was glad I was locked in my cell. Then there came, insanities in the jail. At one point, all the white prisoners on the tear wanted to watch Born Free. There was one TV outside the bars. You couldn't reach it. You had to tell the guard to change the channel. And so Born Free was on, I remember. And all the black prisoners wanted to watch the FBI with Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. This was the debate. On that particular tier, it was about pretty even white and black. I think there were slightly more white prisoners than black prisoners on that tier. And then it came to me to vote. I was the last one in the middle. And you shout out your vote from your cell. And I just said, I don't care. Leave me alone. I just want to read. And next thing I knew, I had a delegation of all the prisoners who were moving around in this narrow tier came to my cell. And it was the black leader, who was the minority. There were fewer blacks than whites there, said that, listen, you have to vote, and you vote with your kind. Those are the rules, meaning I'm supposed to vote with the white people, no matter what it is. So nobody was trying to recruit me to vote for them. They just wanted to keep the hierarchy in place in the jail, even though under those circumstances, the black prisoners would lose every vote, every time. But the guy in charge would rather be the leader of a losing faction all the time than have it mix it up in any way and keep it in place. And I've always thought that not only prison, although that changed later on, years later, but religions are based the same way. It seems like so many things are based the same way in life, that it's similar to what Derek's saying about the lesser jail on the outside and the more intense jail on the inside. I don't want to be too flippant about that sort of a metaphor, but it seems that way. It's just much more intensified in jail. It's much more visible, the hierarchies. And the choice of why would people want to watch the FBI or Born Free to begin with in that circumstance, let alone have this huge argument on it and vote on it. There are a lot of people now in prison from Earth First or from Earth Liberation Front, and some of them are out there in California and in Washington and in Oregon as well. How do you see their actions? Because a lot of them look up to you as somebody who's written a lot and helped to promote, just like Edward Abbey did and others, direct actions, monkey wrench the system to fight against the way things are today and where they're heading. A friend of mine is in prison for a long time now for actions that other people turned each other in on, and he refused to do that. So he's in jail, and all these young people seem to be getting thrown into actions that some of which are good and some of which, in my view, are foolish, but they're not prepared then either for the consequences of what they do or for how to relate to each other when it comes to when some get caught so that they're leaned on and they testify against each other and whole movements get sucked down. What happens when you and your writings inspire people to actions that they're not prepared really to take? I was wondering if you have any thoughts or comments on that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts. First, I want to say that I have nothing but respect for the courage of the non-cooperating defendants. And I have something of a relationship with some of them, by which I mean pen pals. Or I've also done 7, 8, 9, I don't know how many, benefits for them. So once again, I have nothing but respect for the non-cooperating defendants. And at the same time, also, I have to say, I have nothing but utter contempt for those who turned. I want to say something about that, which is that if somebody decides to go that route, if there's a possibility that they're going to turn because they're going to get scared when they're facing 20 years, then what they need to do is to not go that route in the first place. There were members of the Black Panthers and the Black Liberation Army who later said, "I knew when I joined I was either going to end up dead or in prison." My suspicion is that some of the people who turned, like one of the guys who turned, he turned in the police car. He didn't even wait till he got to the police station. You know, they got him in the car and he turned. When somebody is doing that, it suggests to me that their level of seriousness, we need to stop this culture from killing the planet, and we need to do that, once again, using any means necessary. Because there is nothing more important than the planet, and this culture is killing the planet. 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone. The methane burps have started. There is 6 to 10 times as much plastic as there is phytoplankton in the ocean. Take whatever measure you want, and things are really bad.
This is the end, beautiful friend. This is the end, my only friend, the end of our elaborate plans, the end of everything that stands, the end, no safety or surprise, the end, I'll never look into your eyes again.
Once again, I'm not dissing the work that goes in that direction, which I think is incredibly important. I heard a pacifist years ago that I really disagreed with talking about that sort of sabotage and saying, oh, they treat it like it's some sort of college, okay, I hate this term because it's really sexist, but this is what he said. They treat it like it's some sort of college panty raid. And frankly, if you're going to turn like that, you weren't serious about it in the first place. And it was treated as something to do or...
It might have just been something more fun than sex. Isn't that what inspires people?
Well, yeah, maybe that was part of it. But we also have to recognize that there's this great line by the last poets, "Don't talk to me of revolution until you're ready to eat your rats to survive." A lot of the people we're talking about are white middle class, and I am not going to, in this moment, diss white middle class people because that's what I am too. Certainly I'll diss them all over the place, but my point is that for some of them, then, it was a game. It was something to do, as opposed to being a life and death struggle. There are others, Jonathan Paul, Daniel McGowan. Oh, shoot, I shouldn't have started naming them, because now that I start naming them, I'm going to have to name them all, otherwise
That's
I'll
right.
feel bad. The Shaq Seven, Marie Mason, Eric McDavid, who have not turned and have stood strong, and they're very, very serious. One of the things that's going on is that any movement is going to mess up. You know, like I said, you got to write 1 million words before you're a real writer. I think you have to do 1 million acts of sabotage before you're a real resistance movement. This was true of the Zionists. You know, I was just learning about this not very long ago, that the Zionists were basically doing sabotage and doing terrorism and assassinations and all that, but not getting anywhere at all until a bunch of ex-military people joined them. Bingo. You know what I'm saying? It's like, once that happened, then it wasn't a bunch of people trying to make this thing work, but it was a real serious movement at that point.
Can you picture what will be so innocent and free?
And I'm not speaking here in support of the Zionist movement. What I'm saying is I'm speaking in support of sort of, this is a nasty word in some ways, for professionalism.
We had a guest on the show, a friend, Ashanti Alston, who was from originally in the Black Panther Party, a younger member of the Black Panthers, who gave a story here that I kept saying, are you sure you want to talk about this on the air? Are you sure you want to talk? He said, yeah, I'm going to talk about it. He was in jail for 12 years. They had tried for something other than this action, but he had tried with a group to break people out of the tombs in New York City. They went in with an acetylene blowtorch in the visiting room. They locked all the guards into a bathroom and handcuffed them all. He was explaining it all. He told the whole story. He spent an hour and a half telling the story on the air. And they melted the metal with the blowtorch. But what he didn't count on was that the metal would drip down and then re-congeal.
Oh.
And so they got about three quarters of the way through. And it had recongealed on the bottom, and they didn't have enough oxygen in the blowtorch to go all the way, and they had to call the whole thing off. And there are all these people waiting to escape through this hole that they had made right in the middle of New York City.
Oh, my God.
And nobody knew about this. We didn't know about it. I'm sure.
No, I never heard of that.
I'll try to get it back on the air. Maybe we'll replay that.
Wilderness of pain. And all.
Well, we're going to have to come to an end shortly. So I'm concerned, although I don't see it as linearly as the way you've portrayed it.
If you're going to turn like that, you weren't serious about it in the first place.
It's neither one nor the other. People want to be meaningful. They want to live meaningfully, but they're not prepared, you're right of that, for the type of the heaviness of what they're about to do very often. And we found this even, not even in doing heavy actions like taking down electric lines or, although farmers have been doing that all over the Midwest,
right.
But even things like joining an organization and making decisions, people get thrown into by the forces pushing, propelling people. People get thrown into things before they're ready. They get thrown into making decisions at meetings without having the experience to think of what the outcomes might be or what the effects on other people might be. Or just should it be consensus or, you know, things that might seem obvious are not so obvious when you're thrown into that moment, into that police car, into that situation where you're fearful, scared out of your life, and nobody taught you what to do about that.
Well, I really agree with you, and that's what I was starting to get to. You said it much better, but that's what I was starting to try to get to with the movement itself is really immature. And I don't mean that pejoratively. I mean that the movement is young and needs to learn. I know for me, the only way I learn anything is through mistakes. And there are a lot of lessons that can be learned from this, a lot of lessons about security culture, a lot of lessons about what's at stake. And these are the exact same lessons that have been learned by every resistance movement. And these are the lessons that were learned by resistance movements in World War II. And I don't mean in any way to undercut the great sacrifice of those who are in prison at all. When I say that that is how the movement learns, I mean, that this happens. You see it like, you know, the American Civil War. You know, at first the generals are making all these big blunders, and there are real lives, you know, real people who are really dead because the general made the mistake. And then that's not a mistake he makes anymore. I'm not saying, oh, great, you know, we learned that. But it's like once these costs have been paid, then we need to learn from them. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it sure does.
I'm going to be doing a 100 days after Obama's been in office, anti-inauguration type talk in Washington, D.C., I think April 25th. Last weekend of February, I'm doing the ELAW conference in Eugene, Oregon. I have a talk in, I think, St. Louis in April, and I have one in Ann Arbor in April, and I have one in Wisconsin in April, and I have one, I think those are the only ones I remember right now. And you can go to my website and find out more. My website is www.derekjensen.org. That's DerekJensen.org.
Well, thanks so much, and we'll love to get back in touch with you. This is Derek Jensen we've been talking to, Sandy Griffin here in the studio. I'm Mitchell Cohen with Sean Velasquez, and we'll be right back.
The world is fast becoming younger. The news is all they've ever known. They've seen the wars, the hurt, the hunger. How do they choose when they are grown? What do you tell tomorrow's children when it's their turn to hurt and heal? Whatever spins a grim tornado can also turn a potter's wheel. Take a little clay, put it on a wheel, get a little hit, how God must feel. Give a little turn, listen to it spin, make it any shape you want it in. Tell with your life the bloody story, teach to their dreams not burning steel. It's not in bones there lies the glory, but in what's shattered on the field. The potter's wheel takes love and caring, skill and patience, fast and slow. The works it makes are easily broken once they survive the potter's throw. Take a little clay, put it on a wheel, get a little hit, how God must feel. Give a little turn, listen to it spin, make it any shape you want it in. Some children will be digging in some long undiscovered ground, and they'll find our civilization or what is left of it to be found. They'll find the weapons of destruction, but buried deep within that hole, they'll find the message and the promise in that simple potter's bowl. As that water and wind conspire with human hands, love and fire. As that water and wind conspire with human hands and love and fire.
hell is breaking loose around Venezuela. The CIA's battle to destabilize the democratically elected government of President Hugo Chavez in Venezuela has taken a new and not completely unexpected turn. A few weeks ago, Chavez expelled Israel's ambassador to protest that country's bombardment and occupation of Gaza. So last week, so-called vandals, according to New York's newspapers, in fact, there are around 15 heavily armed individuals, but that little bit of information didn't make the New York press, as usual. Anyway, the armed thugs that they called vandals broke into a main synagogue in Caracas, subdued the two security guards, removed security video recordings, disabled security cameras, and then they spent over 4 hours spray painting anti-Israel and anti-Semitic slogans throughout the interior of the synagogue and threw the Torah and other sacred Jewish objects onto the ground. Now, the New York papers have been reporting this as if the government of Venezuela is involved, is anti-Semitic, blah, blah, blah. But the Venezuelan government immediately denounced this attack. Of course, you don't get that here, saying, quote, "We reject all violent acts carried out against any group in Venezuela. We reject this action no matter where it comes from," unquote. But the press in the U.S. refuses to report that the Venezuelan government condemned these actions. In a statement widely released but not printed in papers in the U.S., the Venezuelan government said, quote, "We want to ratify our respect for the Jewish community in Venezuela. An international campaign has been produced to say that we, the Venezuelan government, promote anti-Semitism, and this is just not true," unquote. President Hugo Chavez went even further. Quote, "One should ask oneself, just as any police investigator should always do, who benefits from these acts of violence? It's not government, nor the people, nor the revolution that benefit," unquote. At the same time, Venezuela's private media is filled with opposition spokespersons using the incident to whip up anti-Chavez sentiment. So why? Well, in completely unrelated news, Venezuelans go to the polls to vote on whether to eliminate term limits for the presidency, meaning that Hugo Chavez can run for another term. Of course, there's no relation. Also, let's keep in mind how the U.S. press is attacking Hugo Chavez for daring to be a dictator by extending his term to the degree that FDR did here in the United States. Nobody mentions that FDR served 4 terms as president and that Michael Bloomberg, as we reported, is trying to seek another term and they changed the entire vote of the people on 2 separate occasions to create term limits for the mayor. And Michael Bloomberg is seeking an extra term. Nobody is calling him a dictator in the press. Please tune in again next week to Steal This Radio on NewYorkTalkRadio.net.
Suzanne takes you down to her place near the river. You can hear the boats go by. You can spend the night beside her. And you know that she's half crazy, but that's why you wanna be there. And she feeds you tea and oranges that come all the way from China. And just when you mean to tell her that you have no love to give her, then she gets you on her wavelength and she lets the river answer that you've always been her lover. And you want to travel with her, and you want to travel blind, and you know that she will trust you, for you've touched her perfect body with your mind. And Jesus was a sailor when he walked upon the water, and he spent a long time watching from his lonely wooden tower. And when he knew for certain only drowning men could see him. He said, all men will be sailors then until the sea shall free them. But he himself was broken long before the sky would open. Forsaken, almost human, he sank beneath your wisdom like a stone. Want to travel with him, and you want to travel blind, and you think maybe you'll trust him, for he's touched your perfect body with his mind. Now Suzanne takes your hand and she leads you to the river. She is wearing rags and feathers from the Salvation Army counter, and the sun pours down like honey on Our Lady of the Harbor, and she shows you where to look among the garbage and the flowers. There are heroes in the seaweed, there are children in the morning, they are leaning for love, they will lean that way forever while Suzanne holds the mirror. And you want to travel with her, and you want to travel blind, and you know you can trust her, for she's touched your